Looking at highs of 13 to 15. Sunday, England and Wales stay dry, sunny and warm. Always a little bit cloudier for Scotland and Northern Ireland. And we could see some patchy rain for Northern Ireland and Northern Scotland for the afternoon. That's the forecast.
Nina Ridge. Now on Radio 4, the final episode of our Book of the Week. In The North and Almost Everything in It, Paul Morley returns to the streets of his youth in his exploration of the north of England and what it means to be a northerner. Today he remembers how he came to be in the perfect place at the perfect time to become a music journalist. Manchester, June the 4th, 1976. It's been described as the gig that changed the world, and Paul Morley was there.
For those relatively few curious onlookers who turned up to see the Sex Pistols play at the Lesser Free Trade Hall on the 4th of June 1976, it did not seem any kind of watershed. We were all of an age that meant that we came to music after the 1960s, missing out on all the trends, clubs, events, styles, fashions that emerged and developed back then, vaguely feeling that we needed to find something that belonged to us. We all read the music magazines, so we would not have turned up. We were looking for action wherever it happened. The Sex Pistols arrived in this damaged northern realm as an underground rumour, an emerging, possibly demented pop craze, with something of the impact of pioneers who indirectly understood what the 19th century poet and cultural critic Matthew Arnold wrote in his book of essays, Culture and Anarchy. The great men of culture are those who have had a passion for carrying from one end of society to the other the best knowledge, the best ideas of their time, who have laboured to divest knowledge of all that was harsh, uncouth, difficult, abstract, professional, exclusive, to humanise it, to make it efficient outside the clique of the cultivated and learned, and a true source, therefore, of sweetness and light. And here were the Sex Pistols, tearaways in torn trousers, bringing forth a whole new notion of sweetness and light. The original Free Trade Hall was built in 1838 to hold protest meetings of the Anti-Corn Law League. It was where, in 1872, Benjamin Disraeli defended and praised conservative principles and denounced radical forces in a landmark speech, where Manchester's first cinema show was held in 1896, where Winston Churchill in 1904, as MP for Oldham, spoke in this great hall for 90 minutes in passionate favour of free trade, where the first suffragette protest was held in 1905, where Elgar's first symphony was premiered in 1908, and where anti-Semitic Mussolini admirer Oswald Mosley addressed a capacity audience of the British Union of Fascists in 1933. And then, 44 years later, in the Lesser Free Trade Hall, up above the main hall, playing rock music that was not necessarily revolutionary, but using provocative, restless language, and looking as though they knew much more than their soft northern audience about the radical, political and theatrical history of the building and the rebellious air in and around the place, the Sex Pistols, as insurgent outsiders, took their place in Manchester history. The fact that if you Google, "I swear I was there," you come across more details about that Sex Pistols performance emphasises the show's reputation. Not least because, and this has become an integral element in the ensuing mythologising of the gig, that not that many people bought the 50 pence tickets, but thousands now claim they did. Those who like to nourish the legend favour an audience of around 40. Other less romantic minds suggest a number closer to 100. I'd gone on my 19-year-old own and seemed to recall lots of empty seats and the Sex Pistols solemnly trying to copy and or mock slack rock musician poses with slapdash panache. The audience was mostly male, although the exotic Pistols entourage included some women, costumed in a style that to the long-haired, flared trousers, still fairly cobbled, barely roxied northerners of the time, was somewhere between Fosse's Cabaret and Clockwork Orange Kubrick. The Pistols seemed to be more intuitively aware of Manchester's 19th century status as the world-shaking shock city than the audience. They were for change. There must be change. God save the Queen! The fascist regime! I will never forget Rotten's face and his short, ruffled hair as he strolled onto the small stage, all snot, sneer and leer, with a layer of unstable boyish sweetness and a hint of intellectual raffishness. And he looked down on us, most if not all scruffy boys with long hair and suddenly stupid flapping flares. And then he dragged us away with him. He dragged us away into the future and a world where books have been written and films made about what happened that night, as if there was some kind of fiery mass orgy and everyone there lost their virginity all at once. Six weeks later, the Pistols returned, stronger, faster, harder, darker, officially nationally notorious, quickly, accidentally and intentionally discovering an astonishing way to transmit tricky, subversive messages to a wider audience than the avant-garde typically reached. The Lesser Free Trade Hall was now full of more knowing fans, already with shorter hair and narrower trousers and a tougher edge, each paying £1 to see the Pistols. And the debut of the local, abrasively smart Buzzcocks. Rotten stared at us like he hated us but could grow to love us, although that love would pretty soon grow into disgust, so he might as well hate us and get it over with. We only had ourselves to blame. But even though he hated us, he was going to entertain us, to show us what a wonderful cage-rattling mind he had and what great taste in music. The bastard made us believe in the dark, menacing, anti-conformist fairy tale of punk. Its ability to exercise our intuitions, explore our sensibilities, and sort out the modern world in ways that suited our personal, local interests. And the rest was post-punk history. Complete with hurriedly inserted mentions of the Sex Pistols and Buzzcocks, I sent my magazine out there, professionally typeset and printed for £50 at an Offerton Industrial Estate printers, which my dad helped me pay for, to the editor of the NME, Nick Logan. I sent it with a terse note, suggesting with what must have been Manchester arrogance, Stockport stupidity, or reckless Cheshire cheek, that I could do better than him. He took the challenge well. Because I neglected to put a telephone number on the note, sent a telegram to our new house in Heaton Moor, where we now lived after another move within Stockport. My dad, now perilously close to being unemployed, finding uncomfortable work as a travelling salesman, chased by indeterminate figures demanding payment, had needed to cash in some of the value of the Offerton house, and we moved the other side of the Mersey, into Lancashire. Nick Logan asked me to come to London for an interview, suggesting there was a chance I could actually write for my favourite music paper. A series of self-inventions I had achieved since arriving in the North now reached its latest stage. My father lived long enough to see me write a few articles for the NME, including my first interview with Mark Bolan, which seemed a dream, and even now seems like a memory I've made up to satisfy certain narrative requirements. A few weeks before Bolan died, in June 1977, my dad, not much of a traveller, set out in his car from Heaton Moor, heading for what may or may not have been an unknown destination. Within minutes, he would have crossed the Hidden Mersey, heading away from Manchester, joining the M6 near Sandbach, moving west onto the M5 around West Bromwich, by which time his destination was clearly going to take him past Worcester, driving beyond Gloucester and Cheltenham, looking for the end of the world. He found it and never returned, deciding in the way you must if you decide such a thing, to kill himself in the early hours of what must have been a particularly tense morning outside Stroud, Gloucester, in the southwest of England, a place I had never visited until I went to his funeral, on a day that for many people probably turned out fine. He died in his car, but not in a car crash, crossing a final one-way border that separated him from me, turning blue in the face, thinking that having to survive one more stunning day, one more hour, one more minute, and, in the end, even one more second, was more than he could cope with. a man who had seemed particularly undaring for most of his life, give or take the dramatic move north, executed one monstrous dare right at the end of his life. With such commitment, it wiped him out. He had driven himself to an early grave. What would he have made of Manchester City becoming by the time he was in his mid-70s, after nearly 40 years of retreat, disappointment and embarrassing mediocrity, the richest team in the world, richer even than their monstrous local rivals, Manchester United of Stretford? Manchester City would become once more league champions, 44 years after me and my dad had seen them win the league in Newcastle. And even though there were those who complained they had merely bought it, those who had been around all of those 44 years knew that it had taken more than cash to finally win the title again. It had taken belief and communal willpower, a northern spirit rooted in centuries of shared experience and accumulation of attitude, and a moral purity that outside investment, however immense, suspicious or unlimited, could never corrupt. If my father had still been alive, Manchester City winning the league in a 21st century resembling but complicatedly, technologically removed from the 1970s he never made it beyond? Would it have been an occasion that made it clear, perhaps with a clarity never previously achieved, that we were deeply, fantastically, father and son? And he loved me, and I loved him. And we now hugged all the time, making up for all that time in the 60s and part of the 70s, when we just never did. Because we were in our own space, in our own minds, only connected by a shared surname, and a vague feeling never quite openly articulated that we were in this, whatever this was, together. City winning the league made me think this and about all those years I had spent without a father, without really deeply thinking about not having a father, because it would have been too much to bear. And I cried, not just because it was all so unexpected and exciting, but because I thought of my father. And it felt like he was thinking of me. Not long after he died, I left the North, at least in body. I moved to London to work full-time for the NME, not knowing how long I would be there, not knowing that whatever happened, whether I knew it or not, I was Northern, and always would be. I couldn't feel it banked up behind me, and mostly went out of my way to avoid noticing it. But eventually, it became clear that whatever reinventions I might have designed in the South, crossing new sorts of borders and making or missing very 1980s deadlines, they would never have as much effect on my voice, accent, attitude, character, sensitivity as the few years I spent becoming myself in Reddish and without even knowing it, taking in all that North. As Ian Brown, the singer in the Stone Roses, would say, "The North is not where you are, it's where you're at." To find the North meant perhaps always coming to it, always moving away from it so that you can continually come back and see it as something fresh, something alive, always forming. I'm not saying this because I moved away, but I do feel that to be a Northerner does not mean having to live in the North from the moment you're born to the day you die. The North has become the North because of those that have moved there, or simply visited in spectacular circumstances, adding to the mongrel intensity, the stitching together of myriad forms of otherness. The North has become the North because of those that moved away and look back from out there to see it for what it is, as much as those that stay there.
Paul Morley reading the final instalment of The North and Almost Everything in It. It was abridged by Viv Beebe and produced by Justine Willett. And our book next week is Maggie and Me by Damien Barr. Well, we're almost done for the night here on Radio 4. Just the late shipping bulletin to come after a bit of sailing by. BBC Radio 4. It's 12 minutes to 1, and now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday the 1st of June. The general synopsis at 1800. New high expected Fitzroy 1033 by 1800 Saturday. High 200 miles west of Fitzroy 1034, moving slowly northeastwards, losing its identity by same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. West Viking, northwesterly 4 or 5. Fair, good. East Viking, North Utsira, northwesterly 5 or 6. Mainly fair. Good, occasionally poor at first. South Utsira, northwesterly 6 or 7, perhaps gale 8 later. Thundery showers at first. Moderate or poor, becoming good. East 40s.